Welcome to Unpacking the Digital Shelf, where we explore brand manufacturing in the digital age. Hey everyone, Peter Crosby coming to you from the Digital Shelf Institute's even remoter HQ in Provincetown on the Cape. We call it the Cape, like it's the only one, because, well, we're snobs. Rob's on from the Berkshires. Hey, hello. Rob.
Hello.
So let's dig right in with the big news this week. I think Amazon cuts affiliate marketing. They're cutting the rates on affiliate marketing pretty substantially. And Ben Thompson wrote about this in Stratechery. Rob, do you want to give us sort of a recap of what's going on there?
Yeah. I think this is, to me, it's huge news, not because of its immediate impact on brand manufacturers or their sales through Amazon, but because it signals Amazon entering a new phase of market power and a new ability to flex over the market. So for background here, affiliate marketing is effectively advertising. The Wirecutter is one of the most famous examples of a business that was built almost entirely on affiliate marketing. The Wirecutter was, of course, bought by New York Times in 2016 for about $30 million, which shows how much money you can make on affiliate marketing. And the idea of affiliate marketing is that if you're showing a product on your website, there's a link to an Amazon product detail page. You click the link and then you buy on Amazon, and Amazon sends a small cut of that sale back to the person that provided the link. It is a cheaper form of shopper acquisition than things like Google. And so it's been efficient for Amazon over the years. Now we're in a phase right now where Amazon is effectively saying, we just don't have to pay for acquisition anymore. Everyone is already coming to us. So they're cutting their fees. And that's a huge, huge deal.
And is there any sort of a coronavirus connection here? I mean, Amazon and Walmart had already suspended their affiliate deals at the end of March because they were just focusing on essential goods. But did that give them the excuse to go, hey, why are we doing this anyway? Or do you think, what do you think?
You know, I mean, this is one of these who knows
answers,
but my suspicion is that I'm looking at the whole coronavirus impact on e-commerce, and the mental model I've got is 5 years of growth or 10 years of growth are being packed into just a few short months. We're seeing, for example, gigantic spikes in click and collect that, you know, most of it's not going to be durable after the coronavirus crisis ends, but a lot of it will stick around. I mean, we're going to see probably a double of click and collect market share that's durable well beyond the end of the coronavirus, right? And so if you're looking at e-commerce growth in general being accelerated by 5 years in a very short period of time, the biggest beneficiary of that is, of course, Amazon. And if you look out five years, Amazon's expecting a tremendous, tremendous amount of growth. So the impetus might be coronavirus related, but, and this is a big but, I think it's more a factor of the new scale that Amazon's operating at all of a sudden. Amazon cut their publisher specific affiliate deals that were specifically due to coronavirus in March. Now they're saying, you know what, looking around here, we've got so much demand that we can't even possibly fill. We're tapped out of logistics capacity. We've stopped ordering products from manufacturers because we can't even put them in our warehouse and get them to consumers fast enough. Prime members aren't receiving all packages in 2 days because we just don't have the capacity to do it. Honestly, we just don't need the additional traffic. We don't need to pay people to come to Amazon right now. And I think that's going to stick around. And so you know, while in an indirect way, coronavirus is probably responsible because of it increased demand very, very quickly, that demand I don't think is going to go away for Amazon. Amazon's going to continue to have this market power even after coronavirus goes away.
Yeah, we did have the recent news that just from this week that Amazon's allowing third-party sellers on its platform to resume shipping, so that it feels like some of that was happening is now starting to ease a little bit, and their hiring has been happening. Their surge of hiring 175,000 workers is starting to allowing more products into their fulfillment center. So that's a sign that they're that some of that's opening up. But it does feel like they're, you know, don't let a crisis go to waste. It does feel like this is an opportunity where they feel like they can kind of do this, and maybe it's buried under the news. You know, you and I were talking before the program that it was reminding you sort of the early 2000 with Walmart, right? Like the, when you have power in the market, you exert it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is, everybody around knows that one of my very favorite books of all time is The Walmart Effect, which was published somewhere around 2006. And in The Walmart Effect, they talk about Walmart being a monopsony in effect. And Walmart had, I don't remember the exact market share, but Walmart had something like 8-9% of all retail market share in the United States in the early 2000s. And economists, like in the University of Chicago, were studying Walmart as a monopsony. Now, for those of you who are not economics majors, a monopoly is when you control the supply of a good. And by controlling the supply of a good, you can control the price. You could set the price. So AT&T was a monopoly because they were really the only viable supplier of telephones and telephone network connectivity. And so the government could regulate them. In the retail market, Bazaar Voice was a monopoly on review supply. And so the government regulated Bazaar Voice and split them up into Bazaar Voice and Power Reviews earlier this decade. A monopsony is kind of the opposite. A monopsony, rather than controlling supply, you control demand. And demand are things like shoppers who purchase the good. And if you control all of the demand of a thing, you can also set prices and you could also exert market pressure. And so in the early 2000s, Walmart was at, relative to the rest of the industry, the peak of Walmart's market power. And they used that to flex pretty hard on prices. And you talk to any manufacturer that was working with Walmart in 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, Walmart got their way 100% of the time, basically. And manufacturers really struggled in negotiations with Walmart. Now, the rise of Amazon and the threat that Amazon has posed to Walmart has caused Walmart to back off on the pressure to manufacturers. Walmart's been a little bit easier to deal with in a bunch of different ways because their relative market power is smaller than it was in 2000s without such a viable competitor. And what you're seeing is now maybe Amazon taking that mantle. You're seeing Amazon signaling that it's going to start turning the screw everywhere in the industry based on its market position more than it has been even to this day. And so for manufacturers that thought Amazon's been difficult to deal with previously, I think it's going to get probably worse.
But what do you think? I mean, you know, we obviously are living in a time now where we have an administration that at the top has a lot of antipathy towards Jeff Bezos in particular, but then there's also has been antitrust rumblings going on against Amazon broader throughout the government. Do you think that could offer somewhat of a damper on those ambitions?
You need Congress to get to change something about the law in order to do it. I mean, if you look at okay. antitrust law,
so nothing to worry about there.
nothing to worry about there, man. But yeah, you look at Amazon in particular. I mean, they've got single-digit percentage market share of all retail. I mean, it's, you know, I don't, what is it, half or 60% of Walmart's or 70% of Walmart's scale in just in terms of pure retail sales. So it's not the biggest retailer in the United States. And even if you look at e-commerce, depending on how you measure e-commerce, Amazon's way less than 50% of all e-commerce in North America as well. And its percentage of e-commerce market share is actually declining as companies like Target really get serious about e-commerce and about driving people to those channels, and Kroger invests in click and collect and so on and so forth. So it's hard to
make the case. Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to understand how you would regulate them from a perspective of market dominance and owning supply.
Now the EU might be a different animal because they regulate for a different purpose, right?
Yeah, so in the United States, antitrust law is based on, you know, effectively owning supply and price control, and In the EU, antitrust law is based on fairness. Rather, it's more based on preserving competition than it is on making sure that people aren't, you know, setting prices and things like that. So the EU's existing antitrust system is better equipped to regulate a company that is a monopsony. But there's, and this is again another huge but, they haven't figured out how to do it. So they've been trying to regulate Google as a monopsony of search. They Google owns the demand for search. Every consumer who goes to search basically goes to Google. And so they're a monopsony provider. So if you want to be found, you have to somehow play by Google's rules as a supplier. And suppliers, and especially, for example, newspapers, hate this because it commoditizes them. So in first Denmark about 8 or 9 years ago, I'm going to forget the specific year, and then Germany in 2014. And now this year in France, the EU, using EU antitrust law, is trying to regulate Google by having Google pay the people who are supplying the articles. So they want, the French want Google to, for example, pay French newspapers if Google is going to list the French newspaper's content on Google. And every time the governments have tried this, Google has said, all right, well, fine. We'll just, you know, not show your newspapers on Google. We'll show other newspapers instead. And what that does is it basically drives the traffic to the newspapers to zero, because it all comes from Google. And so the newspapers say, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, we need this traffic. And Google said, yeah, but, you know, you want us to pay for it. And, you know, honestly, I don't see the point. And so when you control demand like that, it gives you extraordinary market pressure. And it's unclear how to regulate it exactly. So the EU does have existing market law around antitrust that's more capable of regulating a monopsony than the United States. But it is, they haven't figured out how to do it in other domains outside of e-commerce. And of course, Amazon is nowhere near a monopsony over in Europe. I mean, they're reasonably big in 6 different European markets, but in none of those markets are they remotely close to as important as they are in the United States.
So Rob, with that being the case, with the monopsony, which I really have a hard time pronouncing, potentially being in place here, what is brand manufacturers' response here? How do they exert power or influence with Amazon to make sure that there's not, I mean, to the extent that they can, that there's not a Walmart-like experience in this new age with Amazon?
I mean, the absolute strategy has got to be, don't be a commodity. I mean, that's the end game here is when you are an aggregator, the only thing that you can't aggregate is something that has unique value in and of itself that stands outside of your domain. So if you look at Google as a search monopsony, for example, the New York Times can still exist because the New York Times has such a strong brand. The New York Times is not a commodity product. So they can grow their own direct to reader subscriber base. It doesn't necessarily make up for the entire erosion of their previous business model, but it means that they can continue to be a going concern and can in fact grow in this new world. They've got a brand that is trusted, that has a loyal base that people love. And we've seen people flex against Amazon using brand as well. Nike is the big example. Every year there seems to be a Nike Amazon story that people talk about, where Nike has a absolutely iconic global brand that consumers love. And consumers, if they go to Amazon and they search for Nike and they can't find Nike, well, you know what? It's not like they're going to turn around and buy a different shoe. They're going to go buy the shoe from someone who sells Nike somewhere else. So a brand that has a brand that is not a commodity, that can't be viewed as a commodity, is safe in a world of a monopsony. And I think if you look across, you know, CPGs or hard lines or apparel, there are brands that have that type of power. That, you know, if you look at like a Canada Goose, for example, in jackets, or a Moncler in jackets, those are not easily substitutable brands. You're not going to go to Amazon and search for Canada Goose and then say, you know, buy something that's not Canada Goose. Like, you actually are looking specifically for Canada Goose. And so brands, I think, when they have lost sight of whatever their unique brand promise is and unique brand differentiation is, that's when they're at most risk. So a monopsony like Amazon, just to get back to the theory of it, an aggregator like Amazon, they are going to seek to commoditize the supply as much as possible. And your response has got to be, don't be a commodity. Have products and have a brand promise that are differentiated and for which there isn't a close substitute. And you'll be able to maintain margin and you'll be able to maintain shopper loyalty.
Yeah, and I think particularly when you think about CPG, I see that happening a lot in terms of Amazon only assortments or ways of thinking of packaging your products together. We have an upcoming segment on the Digital Shelf Summit with a company called Scrum 50 and a VP from Mondelez who's talking about putting together new kits sort of at a high pace to put different products together and just get them out to the consumer to have different ways of selling on Amazon. And I thought, you know, I think that's another way that even if you have sort of commodity products, I mean, Mondelez has some great brands, but when you put them together, it makes something even more powerful. And other companies that are doing that for moisturizers and sort of a kit for caring for your skin and body during this time. I think that kind of creativity and agility in the supply chain can be another way of exerting that power.
Yeah, so two points there. First of all, Mondelez owns Oreo, and Oreo does not have a close competitor for what an Oreo is. You know, my brother, for example, he and his wife buy the organic version of the Oreo that you get at Trader Joe's, and it's gross. It's just gross. It's not. I mean, if you want an Oreo, you want a damn Oreo. You don't want to let the Trader Joe's.
My mom always bought Hydrox because it was cheaper.
I always wanted
the Oreo. I know, it's cruel.
That explains so much.
Doesn't it? It's, yeah, again, it all goes back to Catholicism, but keep going.
But if you look at some brands out there where maybe the product could be viewed as a commodity today, and I'm going to pick on Tide for a second here. Tide has done what you suggest. Tide has invested really heavily in Amazon. They were the first major detergent manufacturer to have truly great e-commerce physical packaging for shipping of detergent products. They've done an amazing job on advertising on Amazon. I mean, Tide's just executed 5 stars out of 5 stars on Amazon. It's a heck of a brand. But, you know, there's a lot of detergent out there, right? And I think a lot of people will buy seventh generation or buy a private label or buy whatever's cheaper. And for an average consumer, it's unclear why you would pay extra. You'd buy that, you know, for that extra margin for the brand in order to have Tide versus another product. And I think that Tide actually could be making a stronger brand and performance argument than they're making in the market. I've been reading a book that I've really enjoyed called Leap by Howard Yu, which was one of the best business books of the year last year. Leap goes into the history of Procter & Gamble in quite a lot of depth, which I loved. I mean, Procter & Gamble is such an iconic company. And they talked in particular about how Tide was invented and launched on the market and how it was the first really true detergent that you could use in a washing machine everywhere in the country, regardless of whether your water was hard water or soft water, and it cleaned the hell out of things. And so I look at the history of Tide, and I look at also the chemical engineering innovations that they've done in the last 70 years since Tide was launched. They have a better product than just about anybody else that's out there. I don't think that's coming across in their branding as much as it could be. So if you've got a product like that, and you really could be claiming to be the best out there, better than competition, you've got a history and lineage to lean on. You want to be making sure that those messages are shown on Amazon, shown elsewhere, and that consumers, when they go to Amazon and they search for Tide, and Tide's out of stock, they don't just buy whatever detergent happens to be available. They say, you know what, if it's not available on Amazon, I'm going to go to Target, I'm going to go to Walmart, I'm going to go somewhere else. And you want to be able to drive that behavior as much as you possibly can. I think that's going to be the big challenge for a lot of these companies that are out there that have substitutes for their product in their category that consumers struggle to differentiate from the leader.
So I find it so fascinating that this sort of to brands seeing affiliate marketing being rates being cut, it's kind of a, oh, who cares? But it really does, to your point, potentially signal this increase in market power. And I, you know, this is just my presumption, but I do think that going through the process of Amazon internally making the cut to affiliate rates now made someone there go, wait, why are we doing this? Like the propensity of Amazon to continually revisit decisions and make big decisions quickly is something that, you know, places them at the top of the heap. What else do you think that this might signal in terms of what other impacts might come as Amazon starts to feel its oats even more in this time?
Yeah, I mean, we talk over and over and over again about how flexibility and agility are critical to winning on the digital shelf. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way that you just phrased it in terms of Amazon constantly revisiting its prior decisions and prior strategies is at the heart of this. You cannot build a business on Amazon where today's business model will last for 5 years. You can't. And a couple examples, the New York Times acquired the Wirecutter. We talked about it earlier for $30 million. The Wirecutter's revenue is going to plummet because of the affiliate fees being cut. So the Wirecutter's entire business model was based on affiliate fees, right? Others like BuzzFeed, Gawker, that had been driving a lot of the revenue through advertising and basically eyeball-based advertising, that revenue has been going down and they've been replacing it, at least in part, by growing affiliate fees. All of a sudden, boom, that big revenue coming in for BuzzFeed and Gawker on affiliate fees is going down. PayPal just acquired Honey for $4 billion and Honey was basically just hijacking affiliate fees. So, I mean, that acquisition looked ridiculous when it happened. And now it looks 100 times more ridiculous because Amazon has basically cut the value of that whole business and cut the revenue stream. So you can't.
Well, and my heart beats for the charities that have been using affiliate fees to essentially go through our website to Amazon and we get a piece of it. And now that's probably going to go away too. So I'm standing up for nonprofit.
That's going away too. And so you can't look at the way that Amazon's behaving today and come up with a 5-year plan. You can't do it. Yeah. You can't build a business model based on a thing that Amazon's doing like affiliate fees and expect it to be durable. You can't do those things. And so it's going to wreak havoc on financial projections and demand projections and supply chain projections and almost anything that you really want to be able to project out as a supplier. It's going to be hard to do that on Amazon. And it's just worth underscoring here that as Amazon gains more and more market control, as it acts more and more like a monopsony, like Walmart started doing in the early 2000s, this problem is just going to get exacerbated for manufacturers. And manufacturers have just got to invest in agility, invest in creative ways to connect directly with consumers, invest in their own CRM capabilities, and invest in other ways to winning the digital shelf that are not specific to what Amazon's doing today.
It makes me think of a little bit of log rolling here because Justin King and I just recorded a podcast episode with John Rossman, who was an executive Amazon that launched and scaled the marketplace business. And he wrote a book called Think Like Amazon, 50 and a half ideas to become a digital leader. And so we had him on the other day, particularly because the whole Digital Shelf Institute is about how do brands make money in the next 2, 5, 10 years? And the lessons of Amazon on how to be agile and how to work ideas through faster and things like that. So we walked through some of the ideas that John has in his books that we thought of how Amazon thinks and behaves that could be adapted to help brand manufacturers sort of own their own destiny. So that's going to be on the 30th of April. Look for that podcast episode because I think it will be informative in this process. And so with that, Rob, I think we've gotten ourselves through another podcast with agility and speed. So I do want to say last Thursday, we debuted Rob's video expanding on his view of what trends will be durable coming out of this period. Coming up on April 21st in the Digital Shelf Virtual Summit, Brian Beck, who's the author of $1 Billion B2B e-commerce, will be doing a live Zoom call about Amazon Business and how it can accelerate the move to digital for manufacturers, brands, and distributors. So Rob, a ton of content coming out to help with some of those things that you were talking about. So you can register and get all the details on all of the stuff that I'm talking about at salsify.com/digital-shelf-summit-2020. Thanks for being on today, Rob.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of you, as always, for being part of our community.